Good morning, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show, where on the second Monday of every month, we set aside time to help you with the latest technology, or maybe your aging technology, or any questions you have about interconnectivity, the internet, artificial intelligence. Whether it's the cutting edge or something that's been on your desk for some time now, our experts are here to help you with your questions. And we invite you to the conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Our guest today is Beth D'Angelo. She's been working in IT for more than 20 years and is the senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, before we get to astronaut emails, we've got a call from Mary in Plover, and I am curious about your answer. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. I've always been a Mac person. A small laptop that wasn't that expensive, I've got a Chromebook. So my Chromebook is starting to age, and I'm wondering if the new, cheaper...
You're kind of cutting out, Mary, and I apologize, but I think we get the gist. It is the decision between a MacBook and a Chromebook, Beth, and from an IT specialist point of view, how do you size the two up? I think from a consumer's point of view, I'd say from my perspective, cost is the first thing that comes to mind for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was really, for a long time, a big difference between Apple products and things like Chromebooks or even Windows-based PC laptops that were quite a bit cheaper than what you would typically find from Apple. But just recently, actually, there is a new product out from Apple called the MacBook Neo. Those start at $599, so $600.
Ooh.
And actually, for education purposes, they're $499, so college students can buy them for even less. So they're now moving into the market where they're creating a little bit lower end, not the fancy high-end MacBooks that we've seen over the last several decades. So a little bit more in the lower end consumer market, much more affordable, especially for those folks in education.
What is it? What kind of software are we talking about when we're making a decision between an Apple computer or a Google computer like the Chromebook?
Yeah, what you're really talking about is what operating system is running that computer. So on a Mac, you're talking about something called iOS. Mm-hmm. The iOS is the operating system that runs in the back end of the machine, that talks to the various programs that you download and install. Also receives updates from the manufacturer for security purposes and feature releases. So when you look at a Mac versus, say, a Chromebook, you're using two different operating systems that have very different feature sets, different schedules for releasing features, for releasing security updates, and they integrate with different software.
And when we're looking at the differences between Chromebooks and MacBooks, we're also sort of looking at the difference between Android phones and Apple phones, aren't we?
Yeah, it's very similar, really, in the way the operating system feels, where things are stored, how to, kind of get into some of the internals of the back end of the operating system. It looks very similar to their mobile phone counterparts.
So, and because here at the University of Wisconsin, which WPR is a part of the UW, we're in the Google universe, and I found it easier for me to move through the Google universe using an Android phone just because of the same operating systems as I use for work, Beth.
Yeah, definitely keeping on the same platform, what we call kind of keeping a native ecosystem where you're say you're using all Macintosh products or you're using all PC products or all Android products, the interoperability between the software on each of those products is going to be a lot smoother if you're staying within that same ecosystem of one manufacturer. But there are tools that allow you to go between them. So if you're used to the Google world, but you have an Apple device, you can still synchronize with a lot of the Google software products.
Why are iPhone users always nagging me about messaging from my Android phone?
Yeah, so the iPhone uses a different type of messaging when it goes from iPhone to iPhone rather than using SMS. which is the standard simple messaging service that kind of all text messaging is built upon. It uses something called iMessage, which is a digital message platform that is iPhone dependent or Apple dependent, that allows you to use features that aren't compatible with an Android phone or something with a different operating system. So maybe you don't have the same emojis, or group messages look a little bit weird because they don't come in the same way. Definitely group messages are a little janky when you go between platforms like that. So it's just easier when everything's on an iPhone, when you're talking to iPhone users.
I get it. Don't blame me. Blame my phone. Hey, Mary from Plover is still with us. I wanted to see if her connection's improved and if we've answered her question here this morning. Mary, did we get to what you were looking for?
Pretty close. But my question is the Neo like a Chromebook? You know, all I do is just some internet searching and email kind of thing. So would that be enough for me? Is it comparable to a Chromebook, the new Neo?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that the Neo is a bit of a step up from a Chromebook as far as the performance of the machine. And as far as the capabilities, anything that you could do on a Chromebook, you'll be able to do on this new MacBook Neo, and then some. So it's going to have a much richer feature set than what you're typically used to with a Chromebook. So everything and then some.
Mary, thank you so much for calling this morning. And you can join our tech conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Got a Slack message last week, Beth, from our tech department here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been here for 7 years now, and it turns out it's time for me to get a new computer. A company-issued computer after 7 years, which you figure is about time, but I'm a little apprehensive. I have a little bit of anxiety because I'm all logged in here. I've got everything just the way I wanted on the computer I have right now. And while it might be a little slower than the newer models, I'm pretty reluctant to upgrade just because of all the work it would take to get into the new computer. So can you put me at ease here, or do you recognize that sort of new PC, new tech anxiety?
Yeah, I think that's pretty typical, especially when you talk about how you have things personalized on the machine you're using, especially one you've been using for 7 years and you use it for work every day.
It's, yes.
You know, something that you've got fine-tuned to your own preferences, and you know where everything is, and you know how to find things, and you can work quickly on it. And that's usually based on what's called a profile or a local profile on the machine. All those customizations, the picture you put on your desktop background, the power settings on your laptop, all those things are customized over time. And when you switch over to a new machine, it doesn't carry over with you. So you have to redo that. And that really is sometimes pretty disruptive for folks to get used to.
Are there ways to make it easier? Is there any software that can help translate? Is there a cable I can connect to take my old stuff and put it on my new computer?
So there are ways to do it with copying your profile from your old machine to your new machine. And it really depends on if you're going from, like, say you're on Windows 11 on your old machine and you're going to Windows 11 on a new machine.
Yep.
Copying that profile over isn't as cumbersome, and it isn't going to cause problems. So if they're on the same OS and you're just going from one machine to another, run a Google search, Lee, on how to copy your local profile from one desktop to another. And that'll save a whole lot of your settings, so you won't have to redo that.
And a whole lot of my time, too, which is,
exactly.
I think, a big part of my anxiety. Speaking of old computers, let's go to Ellen in Eau Claire next. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you have for us?
I'm just curious how I was doing some clean out before a thrift sale. I found a bunch of old phones and a couple old Chromebooks for my kids at school. How do I dispose of those correctly?
Oh, that's a great question. And Beth, where do you turn for these? You just can't throw them out, can you?
No, I mean, you can technically, but you shouldn't. So there are a lot of parts inside of old electronic equipment that when it goes into a landfill is really kind of bad for the environment. There's hazardous materials. So it is illegal to throw certain electronics in the trash. And you want to take a look at the state recycling guidelines for that stuff to find out exactly what's legal and what's not. But there are several places where you can legally recycle those products. Best Buy stores, they'll accept most electronics for recycling. There's also an eCycle Wisconsin website where you can find a list of all locations where you can bring those materials. So checking out the eCycle website is a good way to do that. I know in Madison, we have a place called ReMachines, where you can take your computers over. That's over on the north side. Not sure where you are, but there's also the City of Madison Electronics Recycling Program. So most metropolitan areas have a recycling program for those types of things.
And I would imagine the place that recycles your cardboard and your plastics would have information about where you can go to recycle your electronics, Beth.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, a really good idea is to try to wipe the hard drive before you recycle these things. Or if it's a machine where you can remove the hard drive, I would pull that out of the machine and physically destroy that. So
I was just going to ask that handing over my computer when we were just talking about my profile being so precious to me is another level of anxiety entirely. But how would you go about destroying a hard drive, Beth?
So if we're talking about a laptop hard drive, there's only a couple screws that actually hold that into the back of the machine. So if you flip it over, you can see there's a little disk symbol on there. It looks like a hard disk. You can unscrew that, take it out of the hard drive or out of the laptop case and smash it with a hammer. you also could use a high-powered magnet. We call it degaussing, which will kind of scramble all the data on it to the point where it can't be reconstituted into anything readable. You can take it into a place to have that done as well. I prefer the hammer method just because it's great for stress relief, too.
Well, I would say I would take the hammer method because the hammer is what I have. And when the only tool you
exactly.
have is a hammer, everything looks like a heart.
Everything looks like a nail. All right.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest. She is a senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Dennis and Oshkosh, you're up next with your tech question, and you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on our Tech Update Monday on The Larry Mueller Show, and I've got some news for you. Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., tickets are available for the very first time for the final live broadcast with Larry Mueller for Garden Talk at Bayfield and Bloom. That'll be Friday, May 29th, but tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. online at WPR.org/presents, you can start getting your tickets. They do not cost a thing, but we want you to register in advance, and this will fill out. I don't want to say sell out, but it will fill out. So starting at 8 a.m. tomorrow, you can get your tickets for Garden Talk live from Bayfield and Bloom. That will be Friday, May 29th. Also coming up next Tuesday, Larry's spring tour continues as he will be at the Pablo Center in Eau Claire with our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Tickets available still for that at WPR.org presents. And if you're in the Green Bay Appleton area, you'll be at the Widener Center Tuesday, May 12th in Madison. Wednesday, June 3rd at the Barrymore Theater, we ask everybody to register in advance, please, including at the Bayfield and Bloom's Garden Talk beginning at 8 a.m. tomorrow. All online at WPR.org/presents. Right now, our guest, Beth D'Angelo, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And Ellen earlier was asking about disposing of old devices, and I do believe there is more information from the Department of Natural Resources that you can find as well, Ellen, if you want to follow up there. We'll go next to Dennis in Oshkosh, who has a question about email. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, my question is, Yahoo email switched me over to a different format. And when I go to send an email, the person I'm sending it to, that whole long, skinny line is outlined in black, and I can't type in it.
Oh, that's frustrating. So a new format for Yahoo email, Beth, and it doesn't sound like he can type in the person he wants to send it to.
It sounds like it might be stuck in dark mode. There's a weird setting on some email clients where people like to switch the appearance of the actual screen that you're looking at between light mode and dark mode.
Oh.
So that might be what's going on. To check that out, I'm not sure if you're on your phone or on your desktop, but if you go into the settings and appearance, there should be a toggle between light mode and dark mode that might fix what you've got going on. The other thing you can try is if you're on your desktop or your laptop, you can clear the cache on your browser if you're using a web client to get to it. So if you just go into the settings, there should be a way to clear your cache in the browser settings.
And that would just reset basically everything, and including the settings, I would imagine, on the Yahoo email. And I, you know, when they change up formats on me, I feel lost all of a sudden. I'm not sure where everything is. And I know that I feel like that companies have now caught on that they don't, try not to change when they don't have to, because it is more frustration for the user sometimes than it is usability for the user. So, Dennis, is that what we're talking about here? Does that sound about right to you, Dennis?
Well, I'm not real smart computer-wise, but I don't think that it didn't really change my dark or lightness. It is outlined in black, and I cannot type in it.
And
so
that's,
I will try the...
Wait, and that's for the sender, the person you're trying to send the email to? It's not letting you type it in that box?
Yep, I can't type in it.
Shoot.
Yeah, if it's only that field, then it's probably not that light mode, dark mode.
Right.
I would try, you know, clearing the cache on there is probably, you know, one of the most likely ways to fix any type of kind of quirky issues with what, you know, the actual screen is showing you.
Yeah, clear your browser history, start from scratch, log in all over again for the first time, and see if that doesn't clear things up. The other thing is when they switch the formats or the user interface for some of these, sometimes there is an option of going back to the old feature because they know that it's frustrating for some users. And so, while I don't know that that might be the case for the new Yahoo email, Dennis, you may want to look to see if there is some way to revert to the old system if clearing your browsing history does not work. But Dennis isn't alone with his email problems, Beth, because that was a problem we found on the flight of Artemis II. I mean, these astronauts went further from Earth than ever before in human history, and yet they had email issues. Speaking with Mission Control in Houston 7 hours into the flight from Earth, Commander Reed Wiseman can be heard telling Mission Control in Houston that he had two Microsoft Outlooks open and neither one were working. And all of a sudden, we could all relate to astronauts have never been more relatable, Beth.
It really does humanize them. If I had a nickel for every time.
So how do you begin to troubleshoot something when you've got two versions of your email client open and neither one of them are doing a darn thing?
You know, I got to tell you, this made me laugh so hard when I first heard it, because a common phrase that I hear myself say is, we put a man on the moon and we can't get our email to work.
Exactly.
So this was a real, you know, real life imitating that. It was very funny. That's a, you know, problem that the folks I work with run into pretty frequently, because my team manages our Microsoft 365 services for UW campus. So Outlook is how most of our users get their email. And we have a plethora of Outlook issues that happen on the daily. So this is one we've experienced where you've got two versions of the same client. Neither one of them's working. What's great is Microsoft 365 does have another option for accessing your email if the software that's installed on the device that you're using doesn't seem to be working and you still need to get to your email. And I imagine, you know, the astronauts don't have a lot of time to work with ground control on troubleshooting this issue, because they're pretty busy folks. So a quick way to get around this, what we would call a workaround, mm-hmm. is to go to the web client version of Outlook, which if you just go to Outlook Web, if you do a Google search for Outlook Web, it'll take you to the login where you can put in your credentials and you can get to an actual browser version of Outlook that's not installed on your machine.
That's perfect. One of the what could be heard from Mission Control in Houston was that they were going to remote into these computers, and I've heard that often from our tech department as well. Now, there can be some dangers if you let somebody remote into your computer that you do not trust, so I would imagine with Mission Control, you're willing to trust them, especially to get emails when you're that far from planet Earth. But what should we know when somebody wants to remote into their computer like Mission Control did for Artemis II?
Well, you said the first thing is that is important is that you're talking to a trusted resource. So it's, you know, you're speaking to, you know, let's say it's your work computer and you are working directly with the help desk or with tech support folks in your organization. They'll have software that allows them to remotely connect to your machine without you having to, like, install something or, you know, it may be that they have to send you an email and you click on a link and it creates a remote session. But verifying that the resource that you're dealing with is a trusted, you know, individual, that this is somebody that that you want to allow access to your desktop. If somebody reaches out and contacts you, say, you know, they say, we detected something on your computer, click this link to connect to us so that we can fix it for you, I would never trust anything like that. It would be you reaching out to a support organization for assistance. So if you're initiating that, I think that's a little more trustworthy than somebody reaching out to you.
I was filling in for Larry just last week, and we had a consumer protection show with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection from the state of Wisconsin. And we got a number of calls of scammers who were actually finding ways to remote into people's computers. And it sounded like basically once they got into your computer, they were into your bank. They were into it was like a safety deposit box had been opened, and strangers were able to just pilfer anything they wanted from it. And it's terrifying to me. And so when my IT guy, Zach, says he needs to remote in, I would let him because I know Zach and I know where to find him. But if anybody but Zach wanted to remote in, I'd have some serious questions and want to meet them face to face before I even gave them a shot. Because once they're in, I think it sounds like it is very difficult to get them out again, Beth.
Yeah, I would say a much safer way to go rather than giving remote access to your system would be to do a screen share with the person who's trying to help you. That way they can see what's on your screen, but they have no control over what's happening on your computer. So they can walk you through the steps. You're the one in control of the mouse and the keyboard, but they can see on your screen where you are, what you need to do, and then talk you through that process rather than actually having full control.
Oh, I like this. So
that feels like a less invasive way to go about something like this, and that's something that we tend to use more often.
On my computer, on my keyboard here, I see a print screen option. I can just take a picture of the screen as it currently stands with this print screen button on my keyboard. I could send that photo to a help desk or somebody who's offering to help, and they wouldn't have access to anything more than a picture of what I have on my screen.
Exactly. Screenshots are so valuable to us. The folks like me who work in technical support, who help people troubleshoot, anytime a screenshot of like an error message or the screen that you're on or whatever particular setting you're working on can accompany the, you know, request for assistance, that's going to give us so much information right off the bat. So screenshots are golden.
And safer, much safer than letting anybody remote into your computer, because that would be a full access to everything that you have on there, which these days is just darn near everything. So
right,
please
just
take,
don't screenshot a plain text version of your passwords.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org as Richard did. Richard wants to know, what's the best way to try and control junk mail in Outlook email, Beth?
Outlook has an actual like junk mail feature specifically like right in it. If you right click on the message, you can select flag this as junk option. What that does is it, depending on how you have it set up, it will move that file or that email message to your junk folder, and then it will put a flag in your email so that future messages from that address won't go into your inbox. They'll go directly into your spam folder. And typically, it'll also send a message back to your email provider, letting them know that this is unsolicited junk mail so that they can start filtering on that address as well.
Deb emailed us. She'll be changing to a new HP 11 soon. It's that new computer anxiety. Her prior computer technician believed in lots of free security programs, and she put Obit and Driver Booster in the HP 7 she's using now. She has a different technician these days who comes to the house. He sees very little value in these programs, Obit and Driver Booster, and doesn't even know what they are. Beth, Deb wants to know, is there value in these programs with so much fraud going on, and should they be installed in her new HP 11 coming soon?
I don't know much about Obit, but Driver Booster is, I think IOBit is the manufacturer of Driver Booster. So those, it's the same product.
Okay.
So essentially what it does is it manages the driver files for all of the various things, like pieces of hardware that are either in or attached to your machine. So if you have a printer, if you have a scanner, if you have anything that connects via Bluetooth or USB to your computer, the IOBit software is just managing the programs that those pieces of hardware use to connect through your operating system. So it just kind of consolidates that all into one program rather than you having to download it from each individual manufacturer. So it's just a little bit helpful as far as keeping those up to date.
Okay. So it's not harming anything. Is it still useful in a Windows 11 operating system?
I mean, Windows does its own driver management, so I think it is helpful if you have, like, older peripherals. So let's say you have an old printer that the newest version of Windows doesn't provide drivers for, and you need to be able to keep those drivers up to date from a different manufacturer. That would be a great reason to use something like that.
I have an email here from the Office of Cybersecurity. It's in my work email. It says, it's time for me to complete the latest cybersecurity awareness training, and it includes a bunch of links in it. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a test, isn't it? This is a test of my cybersecurity skills and whether or not I should click through any of these links in an email that I may or may not trust. And you know what? It might just be a legitimate email telling me it's time to update my cybersecurity skills online. What am I supposed to do when I get an email like this that rings true? Probably need to do some cybersecurity for the UW to cross off the list, but also includes hyperlinks that I could click through.
Yeah, so a couple of different ways that you could try to validate that email, whether or not it's from a trusted source. The first one is to look at the from address. Who's that coming from? You want to see the actual email address, not the just display name of it. So hover over that email address and see what the full text of that email address is. Did it come from a WISC.edu email, or did it come from somebody outside of the WISC.edu organization? If it came from anybody outside of the WISC.edu organization, you can tell right away that that's not from our cybersecurity. That's from an outside source. And we wouldn't send anything that wasn't from WISC.edu. The other thing you try is hovering your mouse over, not clicking on, just hovering your mouse over the links that are in the email. And then the bottom left corner of the email, it'll display the address that link is going to take you to without taking you to it. Take a look at that link and see where it's directing you. If it's anything other than a WISC.edu address or something that your organization is specifically linked to, don't click on it.
Well, that's good. I'm doing that right now. It actually looks like a legitimate email.
There you go.
And there was a story last week from our national security agency, Beth, warning Americans to reboot their routers right now in order to thwart malicious international attackers. Their press release says, quote, "Don't be a victim. Malicious cyber actors may leverage your home network to gain access to personal, private, and confidential information. The NSA scares me." with this press release. Well, I guess I should probably reboot my router, but do you know anything more about why they're saying we should?
Yeah, this is an interesting. I've never seen something from the NSA come out to individuals about why they should be, hygiene with their digital equipment at home. And there's not a lot of information out about why this is going out to folks, other than like some kind of nebulous Guardian reports about hackers working for the Russian military are targeting home routers around the world. So that's the only like real information I found, other than this warning that's out there. So I'm curious to know if there is some form of malicious software now that state agents are trying to install directly on routers rather than on your laptop or your phone.
Didn't the FTC ban new sales of routers not made in the U.S. recently, too? Like, there seems to be a few stories like this.
Yeah, so there are a lot of concerns about where routers are being manufactured and backdoors that could potentially be built into some of that equipment. So I feel like there's a lot of pearl clutching and hand wringing without a lot of information about why.
Interesting.
So it'll be interesting to see where this goes once we get a little bit more detail about where these warnings are coming from.
Oh, wow. We'll keep an eye on that. And next month, if there is an update, we will bring it to you here on the second Monday of every month on The Larry Mueller Show for our tech update. But let's now return to your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to Rick and Monona next. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. I'm curious about a thing called Chrome. I keep getting these pop-ups on my whenever I'm on the internet that ask me or tell me to switch over to Chrome, and I've always been reluctant to do that. I didn't want to lose functionality or anything. Can you explain what Chrome is and what are there any challenges to switching over?
Rick, do you know what web browser you're using now to surf the internet?
No, I don't.
Okay. But you keep getting that pop-up for Google's Chrome, which is Google's version of your web browser, but there are plenty of web browsers to choose from, but that pop-up window is a little disconcerting, Beth.
Yeah, I'm curious to know why you're just getting a pop-up about Chrome all the time. That's something that you could certainly shut off in your current browser if you don't want to see those pop-ups. But I'm assuming that you're probably using the whatever native browser came with your machine. So if it's an Apple, you're probably using the Safari browser, or if it's a PC, you're using the Edge browser or the Bing browser. So the difference between that and Chrome, it's just really going to be a different layout. Things will look a little bit different. Maybe some of the labels for the different functions or features in there are going to be different. So like a difference between things being called bookmarks versus being called favorites. They're the same thing. They just have a different name. But I find that Chrome has a much richer feature set than something like Edge as a browser. So you might like it better.
But if what you have is working for you right now and you keep getting these annoying pop-up ads, I would be reluctant to reward those pop-ups by switching over to web. And the other thing is, if you've got your password saved in this web browser you're currently using and your all the cookies for the websites that you visit in there, it would mean starting from scratch with your web browsing, too. I don't know.
You can copy those over from browser to browser.
Okay.
If you need to. But one thing you might want to try, if that pop-up is annoying you and you want to turn that off, if you are using the Edge browser, if you just go to Settings and then Cookies and Site Permissions, there's a feature called Pop-ups and Redirects. You just turn that to off.
Nice. Rick, I hope that helps you, because certainly the question of which internet browser to use comes up very often, and they are all vying for your attention. And briefly, Beth, why do these companies like Microsoft and Google and Apple all want you to be using their web browsing software?
They want to serve ads to you.
You are the target.
And they want to collect your data, and yeah. They want to serve ads to you, and that really is... browsers are kind of a gateway for most folks to all things internet, all things computer. That's really the most often used piece of software on pretty much any device. Getting folks at the beginning of their user experience where they're starting at, so that you can collect as much possible data about what they're doing on their computer, really helps these organizations that provide browsers to sell that information to others.
Let's go to Rick. I hope that helps, and thank you for calling. Let's go to Ron in Land O'Lakes next. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, quick question for you. So I have, like everybody else, a gazillion passwords, and I keep mine on my computer in a document. I have it labeled something else, not passwords, of course, but I'm guessing that's not the safest way. Where do you keep passwords? Where's a good place to keep passwords besides the notebook manually? Because you have to update them every couple months anyway for security reasons. So I'm just curious, where's the best place you would recommend keeping a list of passwords and, you know, what they're for?
My mom uses the notebook method, and it's got a lot of crossouts because it's got a lot of updates to those passwords. But what does Beth D'Angelo use?
So keeping a file on your machine that has a list of your passwords in plain text, I would say, is very, very risky behavior. I would not recommend doing that. I would not recommend keeping any password in plain text anywhere, whether written or stored, you know, as data on your computer. What I would do instead is use something called a password manager. What that is a piece of encrypted software that lives on all of your devices. So when you have a subscription to one of these password managers, you can have a version of it on every different device that you use. It stores your passwords securely and has one main gateway password that you have to remember. So instead of having 50 passwords, you have to remember one password that you can set to change at regular intervals that has it's a strong password secured. There's several of them out there. Google has a password manager. That one is really easy, really accessible. The one I use is called LastPass.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one called NordPass for anyone who's using NordVPN or any of the Nord products for security. They do have a password manager that's real simple. But that's what I use for work and personal, and highly recommend for anybody who has, you know, also it keeps you from repeating passwords across multiple platforms. So if you're using your password for your email and your banking and it's the same password, if somebody gets it for one service, they have it for others. So having a password manager keeps you from reusing those passwords because you can set different strong passwords for every different credential you need.
Well, and we were just talking about web browsers vying for your business so they can target and market their advertising to you, each and every one of them. But each and every one of them is also offering to save and keep your passwords secure. Are web browsers a good place for your passwords, Beth?
I wouldn't store any of my like sensitive passwords like banking or healthcare in a browser password cache. Most of these password managers have an extension that installs in your browser that then when the website asks to store your password, it doesn't store it with that website. It stores it in your password manager instead.
Nice. Ron, I hope that helps. Find a password manager or a notebook, but perhaps take that information out of your computer as soon as possible. What tech questions do you have for our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. We have a couple of emails about AI to get to next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Stay with us after noon today as we take a look at the powers of the president, the war powers as they stand today, and the current power of the U.S. Constitution. A refresher in civics with our guest, Professor David Schultz, after noon today. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and let's continue with Beth D'Angelo, our IT specialist, with your tech questions at 1-800-642-1234 and talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Corey in Dodgeville next. Corey, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a little older computer that I have done the update to Windows 11 on. I used to travel, and every time I new Wi-Fi, for some reason it defaults me to Yahoo as my web browser, and I'm always, you know, defaulting it back to Google Chrome, but for some reason, whenever I change Wi-Fi, it wants to go to Yahoo. It's really annoying. Do you know how I make it, how I stop that from happening?
Ooh, that sounds like your computer's sick, like it's a virus or something, Beth.
Yep. Yeah, that sounds like there's some form of malware on the computer. What I would do is download a program called Malware Bytes. That's MalwareBytes. That is just a little utility. You download it to your machine.
It's
you,
free.
Run it. Yep, it's free. You run it. There's a free version. You run it, and it will spit out a list of any anomalies it sees on your laptop. So if there's any malware installed on there, it will tell you, and it gives you the option to remove things and then reboot the machine. That'll take out whatever code is sitting in the background and making that switch for you.
Yeah, that is a little disconcerting because it feels like it has to do with the internet connection, and a new internet connection means something inside that computer saying, "Hey, let's use this web browser to watch what you're doing online."
Yeah, it's probably like when you're at home, it's blocked on whatever network you're on, so it doesn't happen. But as soon as you get off of your network and onto another network, that block isn't in place. So it's triggering the behavior.
Dee emailed us. She's wondering if there's a way to turn off an automatic response from AI when searching online. Dee also notices that their Gmail AI has a whole response ready to reply to the sender, and they'd like to turn that off too. What can we do to get rid of AI in everything we do online, Beth?
Yeah, so there are settings in each of your browsers that you can go into to turn off the really annoying AI overview that shows up at the top of all of your searches. So it really depends on what browser you're using. If I'm using Google Chrome, there's a setting, let's see, to disable the AI responses. Disable AI search Google. So yeah, it's...
It's not like they make it easy to find. Yeah. I've noticed that part.
I'm looking for the easy way to do it.
Yeah.
Here we go. Okay. Oh, man. So really, you can... This is why I haven't turned it off. It's real pain. Let's see. You can do it in the web filter in Google Chrome. So yeah. if you
it may just be easier to Google it yourself.
It's actually easier just to use DuckDuckGo. That doesn't do that.
There you go. DuckDuckGo is a search engine that is not as intrusive as some of the others, and but they have their own AI as well. And it feels like AI is starting to inject itself in every aspect of our technology and our life. I got a listener called but couldn't stay with us saying they're seeing a lot of news about the connection between AI and organized religion. This may be a little beyond your purview, Beth, but the caller says AI could be used for things like Catholic confessionals, and they're wondering what you make of this and how you see artificial intelligence interacting with us and our beliefs in the future.
You know, honestly, I feel like AI, like the one area that AI really can't replace is in true human interaction. So something like a confessional feels like somewhere where you would want an actual person on the other side of the confessional booth from you rather than a machine spitting it out, an algorithm to tell you how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers to say. You know, things like therapy, social work, you know, confessional, anything where like real human interaction is at the root of what that service is providing is going to be where the jobs are going to stick with human beings rather than, you know, move to an AI platform. And in my opinion, it's to be seen though.
Well, and it isn't a person that you're engaging with. It isn't a personality. As you mentioned, it's an algorithm. It's ones and zeros at the end of the day. It's not somebody with lived experiences. It is a large language model that is trying to some degree, mirror what we're all going through here.
Yeah, I feel like AI does have some application in the... you know, in the sense of, you know, if you want to check yourself on something, if you want, you know, an opinion, a third-party opinion on a conversation or a conflict, if you're able to feed in, you know, objective information to get an objective opinion out of your AI model, then great, use it. It's a great starting point. It's not human interaction and shouldn't substitute for it.
Lynn in Pewaukee emailed us, are Nord and Norton the same security company?
No, those are two different security companies. So, yeah, Nord is one, Norton is another, but they provide similar services.
Let's go to Josh and Madison with some time that we have left. Josh, good morning.
Hi. It seems that whenever I use my debit MasterCard, I get served ads from whatever I get. I'm just wondering how, like, MasterCard is clearly selling my information. How do I sever this connection?
Are there
any other debit cards?
Yeah, where are those ads showing up for you, Josh?
Oh, well, Instagram, for one.
Oh, Instagram ads. So somehow in the meta universe, with a MasterCard debit card, they're figuring out how to target Josh for ads.
That's weird because MasterCard claims that it doesn't sell individual personal sales data. It only sells anonymized aggregated data.
Okay.
But that's what they say. so, you know, there's there's a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation that is talking about that this anonymized data can be used to create like data profiles of customers and that that can be tracked. So while they're not sending data specific to you, they can create a profile about you and use that to kind of serve you advertising based on your profile.
Josh, can I ask, are you using the actual debit card or are you using the phone to make transactions with your debit account?
Yeah, I bought a bottle of Josh wine with my debit card. I never searched it, never got it before. And immediately when I got home, I started seeing ads on Instagram for Josh wine. So I know. So
yeah, what are the chances and what are the odds?
That may be one of those cases of one of your apps was listening to you
when
you were talking about buying Josh wine. But if you want to find out if MasterCard did it, you can actually request through their data portal a review of all of your collected data and sold data. So if you go out to MasterCard's website and you go to the My Data portal, you can review it and you can request deletion of your data even.
Oh, okay. So that's a place to look. And
yeah.
And I still think it's kind of not the brightest that we're seeing ads for things that we've just bought because we just bought them. We don't need to be targeted with them. But once those ad targeting gets to things that before we know we want it, that's when I'll start to worry.
Yeah, when it starts anticipating, you know, this is happening. I've had conversations with friends like, oh, I'm looking to buy XYZ. And later that day, there's an ad in Google showing me sites to buy XYZ.
See, there's no way that that's randomly happening, if you ask me. I don't understand.
No, it's not random. They are actually listening. There are apps that have open port on your microphone that can hear your conversations if the app's running in the background. So that is a thing.
Do we know which apps those are?
Well, it would require you to read all of the end user license agreements of every app you have installed on all of your devices to find that out.
Well, maybe that's something that AI could do for us. We could take the user agreements and run them through AI and ask, hey, can this listen to me when it's on in the background?
Well, you just gave me a brilliant idea for a new app that would scan all of your apps and all of the end user license agreements and give you a list of what each app is doing while it's on your device.
Oh, let me in on this. I feel like we've just cornered the market on helping
Call
Josh.
Call me later, Lee. We got business to do.
We've got a real quick question from Denise and Madison here with a few minutes we have left, and I don't want to miss you out. Denise, good morning. What do you have for us?
Hi.
I
am an older adult and want a computer that will just do really basic things. All I ever do is I want a list of contacts. I want my photographs. I want to have the ability to, I can't remember the word now.
Email and browse the internet. And Denise, I appreciate it. We're short on time here with the 60 seconds we have left, Beth. What computer would you recommend for Denise to do the simple things?
Well, I would say depending on what kind of phone you have. If you have an iPhone, I would go with the new MacBook Neo.
Okay.
It's going to be the easiest thing for you to use. If you've got an Android phone, I would go with a Chromebook of some sort because that's going to be the easiest thing for you to use with it. So
and as you mentioned earlier,
well together.
Yeah, that new Apple Neo is about $500 retail, and those Chromebooks also should be pretty affordable for just the basics as you need them done. So Denise,
they're now pretty comparable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hope there's a place for you to start looking and shopping around. And Beth, very much appreciate all your information this morning. Looking forward to catching up with you again soon here on The Larry Mueller Show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lee. Have a great rest of your day.
You as well. Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology with over 20 years of experience, and it shows. Coming up next, a master class in civics, presidential powers, the war powers, and how they stand today with our military being used in Iran, and the questions you have about the idea of a unitary executive or an imperial presidency. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.